Good evening. So the title of the talk is called "What is the Purpose of the Forms in Zen Practice?" When a new person comes to the meditation hall, she or he notices behaviors that are not customary to contemporary Western society. There's a lot of bowing, silence, folded hands, and an orderly way of moving. This can seem rigid or off-putting to some people. For others, it is a source of comfort. So how could this be? Each of the forms have a functional purpose to them, as well as a poetic one. For instance, the silence or inhibition of talking, the cumulative lack of talking of 30 or 40 or so people creates a cushion of silence. This collective silencing of extraneous thought and pleasantries among people allows for a deeper relationship to grow. The silence, born of the discipline of each person, contributes to a deeper connection among people. When you are silent, your thoughts slow down. Your eyes become more alert. Your body becomes more responsive to the actions of others. As you move in silence with others, you begin to notice a flow or order that you can drop into. It's kind of like swimming in a stream. When you don't know something, the advice here is to refrain from asking others, because you'll only get secondhand experience. If you observe and then participate, then you can go with the flow. So the second form is bowing. We bow to the Buddha, we bow to the cushion, we bow to the group. So what does this all mean? The answer may be unique to each person as she or he practices. So in my experience, when I tip my head over, it bends my spine. This bending over invites a feeling of reverence. I'm humbling myself before something. If it's the statue of the Buddha that I'm bowing in front of, it reminds me there's a lot of things I don't know. That's what the Buddha represents to me, that life operates on a bigger scale than my small mind. So this thought is actually comforting for me, because I think our habitual mind always tries to control events in our lives, especially the ones that we deem to be important. However, I believe we become anxious when we try to control things because we know that we are prone to making mistakes. So for me, it's a relief to know that I can surrender to something that is bigger than myself and that indeed things will still go well. When I bow to my cushion, I'm reminded that I am not alone on this path. The cushion supports me to sit comfortably. If it weren't there, my experience in these 40 minutes would be much more painful. The cushion, situated on the zabuton before my arrival, has also supported countless meditators before me and will continue to support others after me. The cushion reminds me of the other practitioners. Just knowing that others are interested in this path encourages me. When we sit, we do so with an upright spine and with hands folded in our laps. The upright spine signals an alert mind. The folded hands are soft, not tense, and self-contained. This gesture reminds me that all I need is contained in this moment. Everything I need for my spiritual awakening is right here. The point is to be awake and calm. No matter how internally distracted I feel, or how loudly the person next to me swallows or fidgets or coughs. With my seat firmly planted and my spine tall, it arouses a confident attitude that says, all will be well. So after the sitting practice, we fluff our cushions, we wipe off the dust, and ready it for the next person. This action says that we care about the person after us, that we think not only of ourselves and our needs, but also about others, that we exist within a community. When I turn towards the center of the room, I bow again, this time to the community. By bowing, I offer my gratitude for the existence of the Sangha. This is a group of people who want the same things that I do. We are all here to learn a way to live with others that results in peace and harmony. We take time out of our busy lives to quiet the storms inside so that we may have the clarity of mind to behave respectfully, gratefully, and conscientiously towards others. So to behave well means to behave with discipline, restraint in speech, restraint in movement, and the ability to detach from thoughts are all forms of discipline. Many of the mistakes we make in life have to do with a lack of consideration for others, a misplaced word, thought, or deed. Many of us have had experience with the proverbial foot in the mouth. How many times have we said something that was hurtful, not kind, or not exactly true? So conscientious speech is a daily challenge in our practice. This is where the ritual of chanting helps us. Chanting in Zen practice involves 90% listening and 10% vocalizing. In order to chant in harmony with others, we need to listen to the cadence, the pitch, and the tone of the people around us. It doesn't mean to mimic others, but to place yourself in such a way that supports the whole group. So in chanting, be vigorous, but also be supportive. Chanting takes a concentrated and pliable mind. Go with the flow and stop when it stops. Don't stand above others. Don't drown others out. But also be heard. Be strong. Be here. Zen practice asks that you participate in all the ways possible, with your actions, your words, your thoughts, and of course with your heart. It is said that of the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is the most important. By engaging our minds and bodies in these simple acts, we participate in the creation of Sangha. By being quiet, alert, and attentive towards others and ourselves, we create an experience not only for ourselves, but for others. So who is the Sangha? It is none other than you and I. By meditating together on a regular basis, we provide for and protect each other's right to an internal life. Spending the time to sit and observe ourselves is so much easier to do with others and nearly impossible to do by ourselves. By doing it together, we create the opportunity and the likelihood that we may all grow wise together. And that's it.
Are you open to any questions?
Yeah.
So you talked about how in here we're really creating a sense of reverence and respect and kindness and listening. And in terms of carrying it out into the world, specifically if you know someone who is really not accustomed to that, where even your acts of kindness make them uncomfortable, but that you also sense that they like it, but that they're not used to it. Let's say someone who's used to a more hostile environment, and then they're like, "Oh, you don't have to do that. You don't, you know, kind of, you know, being kind and quiet and listening can make them very uncomfortable. But mm-hmm. also, you can see that part of them really wants that, but then they also have to." Still be able to manage in the environment they're living. So I don't quite have a clear formulated question, but I guess what is the best way to bring a kind of kindness and gentleness into that person's life, I guess, while minimizing the discomfort?
I hear that you want to create a connection. You want to create a culture of kindness with the people around you. And sometimes they may respond or may not. I think our practice helps us to be okay with discomfort. You know, I don't know if anybody here ever feels discomfort when they're sitting. You know, over time you develop more of a tolerance for your own discomfort. And I gather that when you sense this other person's discomfort, you feel it in yourself. So you're actually feeling your own discomfort. And if with time this practice allows you to be okay with that, then you're more likely to create the sense of kindness and connection that you want. Because you're not then responding out of discomfort or dis-ease. If you have a wide enough window of tolerance for unease, then you're more likely to continue with your acts of kindness. Does that make sense?
One thing that I think is generally true across many, many religions is that whatever the history of the forms and rituals may be, they take on a very strong reality and are seen as things that have to be done exactly correctly to have the desired effect. You can't imagine somebody being okay with the Catholic community a little bit wrong. Do you think that the Zen forms have the same sort of guru vision you do?
That's a good question. If it's okay with everybody, I'll tell you how I came to Zen practice. So I believe it was in 1997, the summer of 1997. I was on summer break from college, and I was waiting for a teacher. Because I heard that in order to practice deeply or fully, you need to meet a teacher. And so I was waiting for a teacher. I was just hanging out, trying to get a job during the summer. And then there was a flyer on a post that says, Zen teacher in town. So there was this Buddhist monk that was walking from Yonkers, New York to San Francisco. And he was doing a traditional Zen practice called Takahatsu. And that means going with a begging bowl and taking the vow of mendicancy, meaning bringing no money, bringing no food, and relying on the kindness of others. So he walked every day for 20 miles each day begging through the heart of the U.S. I met him in Boulder, Colorado, and I asked him if I could walk with him. So I learned Zen practice pretty much by jumping in the deep end of the pool, you know, waking up at 4, getting ready, sitting by 4:45, doing the chants, doing the bowing, doing the sitting, cleaning everything up, and then walking for 20 miles to the next location and begging for food and a place to stay. So in this sort of practice, I was able to encounter many forms of religion, you know, anything from Methodist, Baptist, to Mormon, to also a lot of Zen centers in the U.S. So we stayed at as many Zen centers that we could find because they're more likely to host us. So in everywhere we went, the practices were the same but not. You know, there was the sitting, there was the bowing, but everyone, you know, did the prostrations a little differently. They sat the same way, but the way they got up from their cushion was a little different. The way they entered the Zendo was a little different. And sometimes we were able to do retreats, which were involved eating practice. And so there was a slightly different sequence everywhere we went. And if you spoke to each Sangha, they would say, that's the way. That's how it was transmitted from the Buddha. And, you know, if you encounter 20 different forms, you would then have a question about, is that really true? And that's been my experience. But the heart of what I learned about Zen practice is basically what I shared with you, is to pay attention, observe, and go with what is there. You know, in that way, you express respect, you express decorum, you express a certain integrity in yourself to have an uprightness to yourself, but also a flexibility and a willingness to meet others where they're at. You know, it would have been silly to come to each Zen center and argue. You know, that there's no point in that. But the point is to be there and to be with. So it's just out of my own experience, Dave, that when you do something with a full heart and you really want to give of yourself and you want to be with the community, people will understand that. And it's okay if you're slightly off. I don't think Les has ever whacked anybody over the head with that. But your sincerity shows. So maybe that's a long-winded answer, but it seems like our teachers look for the sincerity. Yes.
So I was wondering about how to keep the mind focused at the same time relaxed. I mean, both are paradox, becoming opposite each other. So how to bring both come together, make it one, like one is focused means a lot of effort, we have energy here to keep, and then the relaxed mind is still mind, both should combine in a way. How to bring that in the practice?
So I see an image of a pond. So if you know there's, when you look at a pond, there sometimes the waves go over and sometimes there's stillness. And so when you look for the stillness, I wonder if the pond feels tense when it's still. I wonder if there's a way that we can look to in nature and other beings where they're still, but there's no tension about them. Have you seen anything like that in your life or experience?
Sometimes.
Well, perhaps you could spend more time with that.
I enjoyed your talk, Mom, and I liked how you described like the collective effort of silence. It creates an atmosphere that really is hard to do by yourself at home. When we're sitting here together, I've heard you sit for the person to your left and to your right, mm-hmm. and your head holds up the sky. And you described how we set our cushions for the next person with mindfulness for the person before us and after us. So I appreciate your talk. But one thing I notice, like in sporting events, baseball games, they'll have a moment of silence for something, you know, their ball or somebody. But it lasts for maybe 5 seconds or 10 seconds before somebody starts yelling. I think there's something in our culture that can't stand the silence because it brings up, it's uncomfortable, and it brings up whatever emotions people are dealing with. So it's nice that we can come here and create a little bit of silence for ourselves and for each other. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I had a question, but you can comment on any of this. Thank you.
I agree with you. I think silence is very uncomfortable for a lot of people. It's because when you're silent with someone, there's an intimacy that opens up. Seems like silence allows for feeling. You just feel the physicality of the moment, maybe how close or far away you are from someone. You feel your own breath. You notice the other person's breathing. You also maybe feel your own heart. Make sense? Todd.
So nice to see you again, Paul. Mm-hmm. Up there again, by the way. And to listen to the timbre of your voice is wonderful. You should make a tape. One thing I wanted to add, and kind of curious about just recently, I know very little other than what I've read and heard on the radio about this idea of neoplasticity. And what you didn't mention, which I think seems fundamental, is we call it practice, is to continue, as many of us do, kind of setting up, to do this, like I've done many other things over and over and over and over and over, where something happens. So I'm just curious if what you can expand on that. Thank you.
Todd, could you help me understand your question?
It's rhetorical somewhat. But I'm just, you know, we do things over and over and over again. But this is a very special, unusual thing to do over and over and over and over and over and over. And it's known as a practice.
Yeah.
So how it seems fundamental to me that it's in fact done over and over, to continue practicing. That's the heartbeat of it anyway. Mm. So the first, as you said quite eloquently, that it might be uncomfortable to be silent, to be intimate. Mm. The next time, maybe a little bit not so uncomfortable. And then the next time after that. So what happens by practicing? That's the question.
That's a worthy inquiry.
Okay.
That's a worthy inquiry.
Yes, sir.
One more?
So I think it was like a year ago that next door we're doing some construction Saturday morning, 9:15, the jackhammer went off. First thing that came into my mind was, this is going to be amazing when this stops. The silence is going to be amazing. And that's what it was. It was just amazing silence. And it was that silence that, you know, when you were a kid, you lie down on the grass and you looked up, you saw the clouds moving. Or at night, it was quiet and you would look up at the sky. The sky was clear and you could see stars. It was that kind of quietness that came on. It was just phenomenal. Just beautiful, serene quietness came on. And, you know, it's like that's, I think, you know, what you were saying about settling the mind down, you talked about the Sangha, the three treasures, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the Buddha. Buddha is inside of you. Truth is inside of you. You start, if you're really going to start with the Sangha, you start with yourself. And you start with how you treat yourself. You take it outward. And I think a lot of practice sort of has to do with, you know, this, the feeling of awe that we can hold gently in our hands, but this sense that all of our lives we've been told that everything that is around us is separated from us. It's not. Sort of brings everything back together. Like, so when we sit, sometimes it's that kind of a feeling. Yes, there's also the monkey mind which says, yes, you know, I'm sitting so I can jump up and down, but that is always there. These feelings are always there and they come. God, I was thinking about all these things while you were talking about, especially about the Dharma and the Sangha, but beginning with yourself is, I think, the biggest challenges that we have with our practice is to sit with ourselves and know what our own truth is, what, who we are, and how we even talk to ourselves. So once we start changing that internal dialogue, I think the external dialogue will start to change too.
That's a very good point, Umar. So I think that's a mistake a lot of people think about Zen. They think that Zen is people withdrawing from life, people leaving their community or leaving their life and doing something so selfish as to just work on themselves. You know, and what you said could be construed as such. But when you actually do this practice, you realize how dependent you are on everyone. Imagine all of us are sitting here, we sat here together. And if one person broke their discipline and just started screaming, I mean, we all have that power. Anyone could have done it. And we were so reliant on each person's willingness to be disciplined, to care about others enough to restrain themselves, to act in moderation. You know, when we come here, we only have this experience. We're only able to really observe ourselves because of the other people around us. And when you come here, you actually learn that indeed you're not selfish. And that the most unselfish thing you can do for your family and your friends and your community is to practice, to learn how to modulate yourself, how to restrain yourself, how to act in a way that supports other people. So when we bow to each other, it's an act of gratitude. I'm so grateful for every person here. You know, without you, this would not have been possible. So when you practice, you realize we need each other.
And it was winter, so I was not cold place, raining, cold, there was a lot of mosquitoes. So I came to a family, completely different place. I lived in apartments, food, house, a lot of different things. So if anybody spoke to me in the neighborhood, in the family, I would just be quiet and staring at them in silence. Inside me, I thought I was communicating a lot because there's so much coming in my brain, then what I could give up. And the concern that I had was if I say something that I don't like something, or I don't follow what that person, like I didn't sometimes follow what that person say, or I wouldn't understand why things are done in this way, and I would be thinking, if I say something, would it be right? Would it be hurt? Would it be okay to say this kind of thing in this culture? Or would it be okay if I say I want to do this? So the first 1 or 2 months was like, look blank and stare. And it's like, I agree with this. People are not used to the silence, and one of the times I got this thing as, hello, you're not talking to the walls, you're talking to you. Right? So, but here, of course, when we practice here, silence is so much understood and as part of communication.
Mm-hmm.
But it is true that many times when somebody is quiet, they are communicating, it's just not accepted as part of communication. And I don't know why. Mm-hmm. So, this practice kind of also brings out the importance that you can communicate a lot by sitting and staying silent. So if you can share your opinion on why silence is misunderstood to be not acceptable or something. Mm-hmm. If you see, when you're communicating, if you're trying to communicate and the person opposite is quiet, and for a long time, sometimes the person gets angry. Right? And before you're quiet, the anger goes up. But there is a communication, but it's not identified, and I don't know why. Okay, if you
could you share your name with me?
Sharmina.
Do you feel supported here?
Very much.
Do you feel like this is a place where you can be yourself?
Very much.
I'm happy to be a part of that for you.
Sashina is coming up in 3 Saturdays, not this Saturday, not next Saturday, but the Saturday after that. And is it the day before? It's the second, it's the second Saturday of August is when Sashina is. Sashina is one day sitting, which is broken up into walking and sitting meditation. With meals in between, and so it will be the second Saturday. I will be putting sign-ups outside soon, within a few days. So if you would